Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with author and activist Bill McKibben, co-founder of global climate campaign 350.org, and author most recently of Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? Let me set this up for you. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, and Robert Wright on why he's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. Let me give you a quick plug for participation. I think it's really important that we all take what we know, take what we've learned, take what we feel, and act on it. So some organizations that are active on all issues are indivisible.us. The word indivisible.us, they emerged right after Trump's election, and they have local groups in about 5,000 communities, and they will send you a weekly email telling you, here's what's up this week, here's what to do, here's who to call. MoveOn.org, been around since 92. And was for most of its time primarily digital, working more closely these days with grassroots folks on the ground. MoveOn, oneword.org. In the state of California, similar to MoveOn, CourageCampaign.org. Courage Campaign, one word, again, digital for most of its life, but now working very closely with grassroots. Two very specific ones, fivecalls.org. That's the number five in the word calls, fivecalls.org, which will tell you the most relevant and timely calls you need to make to your representatives. Townhallproject.com, townhallproject1word.com. They will tell you when your representatives or nearby representatives are going to be holding town halls, are going to be in town where you can go and speak to your representatives in person. And then finally, if climate change is what matters to you, 350.org, the organization co-founded by Bill, and they will tell you where to act, what's happening both legislatively, activist-wise, and so on. 350, the number, 350.org. And now to today's guest. My younger brother gave me Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature, for Christmas 30 years ago. It was the first mass audience book about climate change, and my brother chose that book to inscribe the message that he felt he'd gotten his social conscience from me. So it has a special place in my heart, as well as my library. What Bill McKibben has done in those 30 years is remarkable. Two of his books, two that don't even focus on climate, that I highly recommend, are Deep Economy, a wise book about what really matters, what really has value, and the high price we pay for our loss of community. And then the prescient, The Age of Missing Information, for which Bill watched an entire day's worth of television on the 93 channels available in 1992 in Fairfax, Virginia, and what he felt that said about what people knew and how informed a democracy might be, all of which has only gotten exaggerated and worse since the rise of the internet. And if you were to pick that book up in a new version, he would have some new information, new data dealing with that. His contributions regarding climate change go beyond books and articles. Though one article in Rolling Stone, 2012's Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, changed the way many looked at energy reserves and made the case, the strong case, for the fossil fuel divestment movement. He's co-founder, as I said, of the global climate campaign 350.org, among the most effective climate or activist organizations in the world. His argument in The End of Nature that the survival of the globe is dependent on a fundamental philosophical shift in the way we relate to nature is more relevant than ever, and today he's writing about the potential end of what he calls the human game, human society as we know it. In 2014, Bill McKibben was awarded the Right Livelihood Prize, sometimes called the Alternative Nobel. As I said, founder of 350, which has organized 20,000 rallies around the world in every country save North Korea, and spearheaded resistance to the Keystone Pipeline and launched the fossil fuel divestment movement. Bill is the Schumann Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at Middlebury College, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's written 17 books. I mentioned a couple of them. His latest is Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? Welcome again, Bill McKibben, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Well, friend, it's always good to get to talk with you.
Thank you. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Sunday, April 14th. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about, and I've laid out some of the highlights on. But can you? How do you tell your story when you talk about your path? And you can go way back, mentioning mentors, well, turning points, those moments of decision.
Sure. You know, I'm not an activist by nature or training. I'm a writer. My first job out of college was writing the Talk of the Town column for the New Yorker back in the early 1980s at the end of Mr. Sean's run as the greatest editor of the 20th century at the New Yorker. And I enjoyed that immensely. While I was there, I wrote a long piece. It was a kind of chronicle of where everything in my apartment came from and how it got there. So I followed the electricity lines, you know, back to the subarctic where Con Ed was buying hydropower and out to the Grand Canyon where they were mining uranium for the reactor at Indian Point and off to Brazil where they were getting low sulfur oil for their big power plants. And then I followed the water lines and the sewer lines and so on and so forth. That piece gave me, I think, a much stronger sense of the world as a physical place. So I'd grown up in, you know, good suburban America, and the suburbs are kind of a way of hiding all the things that you need to make a life work. You know, no one has any idea where the rivers are or the streams, and, you know, the subdivisions are named for the things that used to be there.
That's right.
Fox Ridge or whatever. I've been living in Manhattan, which is a place that seems to be able to mint money out of thin air just on sort of sheer power of ideas. But to be reminded that actually it was exquisitely dependent on the rain falling and so on, I think that set me up to read a year or two later the earliest science on climate change and to understand as I was reading it that what it was describing was a very real threat to a very vulnerable world. We take very much for granted the physical stability of the planet. And in one sense, why not? I mean, it's been stable throughout human history. But what the early science on climate change was indicating was that that stability was coming to an end. And I knew enough from that other reporting to make that have me tremble just a little bit. And that's why I wrote quickly and in a kind of fever, this book, The End of Nature, in 1989. I guess I was 27 when I was writing it, 28 when it came out. And it has some of the hallmarks of a of a young person's you know, enthusiasms, maybe over-enthusiasms. But I'm afraid the book has stood up all too well. In fact, what were warnings of a threat to come in 1989 are, by this point, the daily news for hundreds of millions of people around the world for whom climate change has become the absolute most pressing reality.
Okay. You said it right at the top of that answer that you're not an activist by nature. And it occurs to me, how do you combine the life of an author, which is a solitary art, working at a magazine, maybe a little less so, but working on books, pretty solitary, with the life of an activist, which by its nature demands to be social?
Well, I'll tell you the story. It took me a number of years to figure out what I needed to do. When I wrote The End of Nature, as I say, I was in my late 20s and didn't have that much sense of the world. I think my theory of change was people will read my book and then they will change, which is not, as it turns out, precisely how it works. I spent the next 10, 12 years writing more books, writing articles, giving speeches, on the mistaken theory that we were engaged in an argument about climate change, that if we could pile up enough data and reason and so on, that eventually the powers that be would take note and say, okay, now we must do something. And it took me that decade to figure out that we weren't really in an argument at all. I mean, we'd won the argument early on by, say, 1995 at the latest. The world scientists were in complete and robust agreement about what was going on. We'd won the argument. We were just losing the fight because the fight was about what fights are always about, not reason and data, but money and power. And the fossil fuel industry had so much money and hence so much power that they could lose the argument but still win the fight without any problem. And it was at that point that it began to occur to me that we better figure out how to stand up to that power. Now, clearly it wasn't going to come from having money the way that Exxon did. Exxon made more money in those years than any company in the history of money. We were going to have to instead do what on occasion Americans and people around the world have done when they were up against a powerful status quo, and that was build the kind of movements that could begin to counterbalance that power. And so that's what we set out to do. I mean, and it was not like we knew what we were doing. I mean, 350.org began with myself and seven undergraduates at Middlebury College. There were seven students. There are seven continents. Each one took one. The guy who got the Antarctic also had to deal with the internet. That's how we set out to organize the world. And what do you know, with a certain amount of beginner's luck and with the fact that it was a kind of unfilled ecological niche, we had a fair amount of success. Our first big global day of action, we coordinated 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries. CNN called it the most widespread day of political activity in the planet's history. We've gone on to coordinate about 20,000 rallies in every country on Earth except North Korea. We launched the sort of most active phase of the fight against the Keystone Pipeline, which in turn has turned into a fight around the world against almost every form of fossil fuel infrastructure. And we launched, as you said, this divestment movement, which has grown into the largest anti-corporate campaign perhaps in history. We're at $8 trillion worth of endowments and portfolios that have divested in part or in whole from coal and oil and gas. So it's not as if we're winning. The temperature's still going up. But we've taken a bite out of the fossil fuel industry, and we'll continue to do so, I think. And the question isn't whether we can beat them in the long run. We clearly can. The price of a solar panel keeps dropping every day, and so they become more vulnerable all the time. The question is whether we can beat them in the short run or not, whether we can make the transition happen fast enough to catch up with the physics of climate change. That won't happen on sheer economic trajectory alone. It's going to take the kind of pushing and prodding that only movements can provide. I don't know whether we got started in time or not. I mean, I kick myself for not figuring it out earlier and not getting started on it earlier. But we're doing what we can now. And as to the question of how one trains one's personality, I mean, look, all writers, in a sense, are introverts. I think if they weren't, they wouldn't. That isn't how they'd communicate with the world. And so for me, it's been a little difficult, but doable. And the great fun of it has been to find so many people in so many places around the world that want to help out. And many of those people, Terrence, are in places that didn't cause this problem, where no one really burned enough fossil fuel to raise the temperature a whit. And the fact that they're willing to work with us and join in this big movement gives me the kind of constant inspiration to keep moving forward myself.
A couple of things right there. I actually was in the audience at the UCLA Student Union when you and some of the other initial activists on your very first sort of tour, starting 350.org. I was just one of the many sitting there.
I remember that.
Yeah. And another thing that you I've heard you say and write lately is we're all going to, I'm saying this to your thing of having to learn how to be an activist while being an introvert. We're all going to learn how to get out of our comfort zone because the earth is a mile out of its comfort zone.
That's right. I mean, that's really the thing. And I say that to people all the time. And, you know, everybody has a comfort zone, and it's difficult to get outside it. I remember the first time that I was going to go be arrested, and I was sitting on the sidewalk in front of the White House, and the police were saying, now it's time to get up and leave. And part of me wanted to because, you know, I'm used to doing what police tell you to do, and probably in a working society, that's in general a pretty good rule, you know. But it was important not to, and so one stood one's ground, and one went to jail for a few days. And, you know, at least for people who look like me and come from where I come from and stuff, going to jail is not the end of the world. It's not pleasant, but the end of the world is the end of the world, and that's why one does what one can. For some people, going to jail will be the thing that's outside their comfort zone. You know, but not everyone needs to. For other people, you're finding other ways to join in. But clearly what we're doing at the moment isn't enough, so we better push a little harder.
Yeah, I want you to, something I've heard you say about one of the first big demonstrations or one of the bigger demonstrations that you folks did in Washington. You spoke to the boomers when you were talking about getting arrested. And do you want to share that? Because I'm sure some of them are listening.
Yeah. I remember writing the letter that asked people to come get arrested there. And I said, look, I think this is one of the cases where the young people shouldn't have to be the cannon fodder for this. You know, young people are leading this fight around the world. I mean, look right now. We'll talk about the Green New Deal and Greta Thunberg and things, and that's been the way for years. But if you're 19 or 22 or something, it's possible an arrest record is not the absolute best thing for your resume. Whereas, you know, once you've reached a certain age, well, what the hell are they going to do to you? And so it was good to see people who, you know, with hairlines like mine, arriving in Washington to get arrested at the start of that Keystone fight, which was the biggest civil disobedience action about anything in this country in many years. We didn't ask people, how old are you? Because that would be a little rude. But I think cleverly we said to people, who was president when you were born? And the two biggest cohorts were from the FDR and the Truman administrations. On the last day, there was a guy arrested with a sign around his neck that said, World War II vet, handle with care. He was so old, he'd been born in the Warren Harding administration.
Whoa.
Which was so long ago, I confess I'd pretty much forgotten there was a Warren Harding administration. What was good was for young people who were there to see their elders acting in the way that really we need elders to act in a working society. And since then, I've had lots and lots of people tell me that civil disobedience is definitely on their bucket list. And we'll continue to give people opportunities to fulfill that ambition.
Okay, and let me tell people that this is Freeform, a World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with author and activist Bill McKibben, co-founder of the Global Climate Campaign, 350.org, and author most recently of Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? Since I started this off talking about the end of nature and then Falter, and you talked about the first decade, and you've talked a little about the second decade, but how do you see the 30 years in between those two? And what has surprised you in terms of the climate evidence, if you will, right?
Well,
and then the second part will be, what has surprised you in terms of our response?
Okay. Let me think. I mean, surprised me in terms of the climate evidence is that things have moved much more quickly than we would have thought. 30 years ago, remember this is an experiment that we haven't carried out before. It's been, tens of millions of years since the last time we had a real runaway flow of CO2 into the atmosphere. We knew that the planet was going to heat up. I mean, the molecular structure of carbon dioxide means that it traps heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. When you burn coal and gas and oil, you get CO2. It wasn't hard to draw that conclusion, but how fast and how hard that would pinch were unknowns. And as it turns out, scientists are conservative in their estimations, and things pinched much harder and much faster than we would have guessed. The stuff that is happening now, we would have thought in the 1980s would be happening in the 2080s. So, to see that we've already lost half the summer sea ice in the Arctic, that the ocean is already 30% more acidic, that we're already seeing 60% more, downpours and rainfalls in the northeast United States, that California has already endured a drought of epic scale, that fire season where you live has now become a year-round kind of sense of lingering dread. Those are things that we wouldn't have predicted would happen yet, but they are, because the planet turned out to be much more really finely balanced, in a sense, than people had realized. What surprises me about the response is precisely the opposite, just how slowly the world has reacted to what, by any measure, is the greatest threat and crisis it's ever faced. There are many reasons for that slow response, but the biggest one by far, the one that really has prevented action, was that the fossil fuel industry decided it was going to make sure we didn't act. You know, we know from great investigative reporting at the LA Times, the Columbia Journalism School, great websites like Inside Climate News, who dug through archives and whistleblowers and things. We know, we've learned in the last 3 or 4 years, that companies like Exxon knew everything there was to know about climate back in the 1980s. Look, carbon was their product. They were the richest company in the world. They had great scientists on staff. They made it their business to understand. By the early 1980s, scientists were telling them, bluntly, how fast and how much it was going to warm. And those scientists were believed. Exxon began building every drill rig that it built to compensate for the rise in sea level that it knew was coming. What they didn't do was tell the rest of us. Instead, they made a kind of explicit decision right around 1990 that they were going to set up a sort of architecture of deceit and denial and disinformation designed to spread the idea that there was doubt about what the future held. They hired people from the tobacco industry. They hired people left over from the fight to discredit Rachel Carson in the 1960s. And they set to work with all the tools at their disposal, mostly money, to accomplish this. And they succeeded. I mean, look, the President of the United States believes that climate change is, quote, a hoax manufactured by the Chinese, which is an idea so dumb that if you heard someone next to you on a public bus muttering about it, you'd get up and change seats, you know. But this is this is where we are. This is the most consequential lie in human history, because it wasted 3 decades on an utterly stupid debate about whether or not global warming was real. A debate, remember, that both sides knew the answer to when the debate began. It's just that one of them was willing to lie. And in the process, they kept their business model going for those 3 decades, reaped huge profits, and melted the poles.
Yeah, yeah. I'll throw this one in here now, and then we'll break it down as we go on. You also have written some fiction. You wrote your first novel a couple of years ago, Radio Free Vermont, which you call A Fable of Resistance. If you were to use your fictional imagination, If you're standing in the future, 10, 15, 25 years have passed and you're looking back, did we turn things around? And when you look at that story, can you imagine it? Can you imagine the moves that happened that helped us be successful in, and by the way, success because of those 30 wasted years is no longer what it looked like then. Success
That's
now
right.
is maybe 2 degrees, which means not avoiding what's happening already, the wildfires, the floods, but maybe avoiding the loss of civilization completely.
Yes, that's just right. Stopping global warming is no longer on the menu. Maybe slowing it down enough to prevent the loss of civilizations is, although even that's an open question at this point. Yeah, look, I can tell you lots of good stories about how the world could change, and you can even see the beginnings of them right now. Look at the remarkable work that people from the Sunrise Movement are doing with this Green New Deal proposal. These people are close to my heart. They're mostly recent college graduates who cut their teeth on the divestment movement when they were in college. And now they've gone on to push this Green New Deal hard. And, you know, they've got Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez kind of as their bellwether. But they're building enormous power behind this idea. And those guys who are in their, you know, early and mid-20s look positively ancient compared to the 12-year-olds and 14-year-olds and things that are following Greta Thunberg, this remarkable Swedish schoolgirl who went on climate strike in September in Stockholm in a move that's galvanized opinion, at least of young people, all around the world. So now imagine if, and here we're turning slightly more fictional, but maybe hopefully just a little, we could figure out ways to get adults mobilized in the same way, to disrupt on occasion business as usual, the way that kids are disrupting education as usual. Say we were able to pull off some big one-day strikes around the world that really began to push our leaders in a new way. Imagine that one of those leaders took control of the U.S. in the next election. Perhaps they seized the opportunity that the Green New Deal presented to do what, say, FDR did in the early days of the Second World War, transform our industry in the direction of fighting climate change, building the wind turbines and the solar panels that are the guns and tanks of this particular war. One could imagine it happening, and one could imagine that as we did it, we'd reap all sorts of other benefits too. I mean, one of the good things about renewable energy is it's not concentrated in a few spots like coal and gas and oil. It's everywhere. And so as we turn to it, we'll be dismantling some of that undue influence and power that goes with happening to control those particular patches of ground. I mean, there'll be rich people in a solar world, but there won't be oil and gas barons like the Koch brothers who have a chokehold on things and are able to use it to put a chokehold on our politics. So I can write you a good story. The question is whether or not it comes true. And that depends, I think, most of all on how many people get involved and how involved they get. We desperately need a movement, and we've got the beginnings of one. It just needs to be larger.
Okay, I'm going to pull some threads out of that as we go. But one thing I wanted to mention was one of the essence of the Green New Deal and why that title was chosen, I'm sure, is to echo World War II and First World War II. And previous to that, the New Deal, as ways that America dealt with the Depression and the Allied forces. Lester Brown made exactly that point with Plan B. What is that? Is that 20 years ago now, you know?
Something like that, yeah.
And so it's funny when you see people saying, oh, these are young people who, you know, they're naive, they don't know. And Lester, of course, is one of our great elders. And had experience started in the, I think, American Food for Peace program in like 1962, you know. But but if you could spell out for people, just because I think what's happened at this point is Green New Deal has become something people argue about. I'm not sure something they know about. So flesh it out a little.
Sure. The Green New Deal, I mean, it's still being fleshed out, but the Green New Deal is this set of policies that young people mostly came up with and began presenting. And one of the key moments of this came in the autumn when they staged a small sit-in at Nancy Pelosi's office in Washington. And somewhat unexpectedly, they were joined at this sit-in by newly elected Bronx Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez. It's not a normal thing for congresspeople to sit in at the Speaker of the House's office, but there you were, and it grabbed everyone's attention. And she handled it gracefully and well, not putting it as a challenge to Pelosi, but as a possibility, as an opportunity. The important thing to realize about the Green New Deal, I think, is that it's the first time that people have presented plans that are on a scale commensurate with the size of the problem. So the things that are in it are like a federal job guarantee for anyone who wants it. Well, we're going to need a lot of hands if we're going to put up renewable energy at the pace it would take to decarbonize our economy inside of a decade, which is the goal of the Green New Deal. That's hard work. It takes lots of hands. It's doable work now. 10 years ago it wasn't, but in that 10 years, the price of solar panels dropped 90%. Wind power and solar power are now the cheapest way to generate electrons around the world. If we wanted to, we could make this decisive move. What's lacking is not technology. What's lacking is political will. And the Green New Deal is an effort to summon that political will.
So one thing I wanted to jump in and
we're conducting a kind of roadshow, a tour around the nation this summer, and people should go and take a look at it. If you go to Sunrise Movement on the web, you'll quickly find the details. And these are very, very, very talented human beings, and it's worth your while to catch up with them.
Is that Sunrise Movement, two words?
Sunrise Movement.
Yeah. Okay, .org.
I believe so.
Okay, two things I wanted to mention. One is that I think a lot of people do not know that the Green New Deal includes help for those who lose their jobs in the fossil fuel industry, that it's about jobs as well as environmental things and so on. And that's what I think is some of its most attractive elements are that, as you said, it is a comprehensive approach. And I think as people actually do a little bit of research, they will become better able to understand and support it on their own, and better able to argue for it with others.
I completely agree.
One of the other things is that it's funny because the anti-immigrant, anti-we're losing our jobs to other countries energies of the White House and its base of support. One thing you got to remember it's worth noticing, is that when you retrofit a building, when you put up a solar panel, when you put up wind turbines, these are not jobs that can be exported. These cannot be done elsewhere. The hands
on the... No one's going to put their house on a boat and send it to China to get it insulated.
Exactly.
It's got to happen here, and it's really hard to think of another source of millions of good new jobs in the coming decade or two. This transition is that opportunity. And, you know, what's really interesting about it, of course, is that in many ways it pays for itself. I mean, even laying aside that it might help us avoid some of the truly staggering costs of a world racked by climate change, just think about your house. You know, you pay the money to put in good new insulation, and then you're paid back over the course of a very few years by the by the savings on your heat bill. You put up solar panels, and once you've got them up, well, I mean, the sun comes for free. That's why Exxon hates it so much. They've been in the business for 100 years of having people write them a check every month for more fossil fuels. They think that the sun providing all that energy for free is just the stupidest business model of all time.
Right.
But for the rest of us, it's a pretty good bargain.
Yeah, what's been renewable for them is our weekly demand to fill up the gas tank.
Exactly right.
And let me just point it out. You said even leaving aside the enormous costs that we'll face if we don't do this, I'm just going to read a couple of quotes from things I've read of yours recently. Testimony submitted by climate scientists to a federal court in 2017. If we don't take much stronger action now, future citizens would have to pay $535 trillion to cope with global warming. And you break that down to an example. One small county in Florida, which needs to raise 150 miles of road to prevent flooding from even minimal sea level rise, that costs $7 million a mile, putting the price tag at over $1 million in a county that has an annual budget.
Yeah.
Over a billion, yes, thank you, that has an annual road budget of $25
million. Yeah, I mean, look, there's literally not enough money on Earth to pay for the damages of runaway climate change. I'm sitting here in Manhattan right now. We're a few feet above sea level. Imagine the cost of trying to relocate Manhattan, Miami, Mumbai, all the other coastal cities of the world. You really can't do it. We have to adapt to a certain amount of climate change. I mean, I think the mantra is adapt to that which you can no longer prevent. But the even more important call is to prevent that to which you cannot adapt. And that's what we're really facing now. That's why critical, quick action on climate change is so crucial. Because if we don't get it, there's just no way that we can deal with the world that's coming.
Yeah. And this is Freeform, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally, and the other voice you hear is Bill McKibben, co-founder of Global Climate Campaign 350.org and author of 17 books, most recently Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? You can learn more at BillMcKibben.com. One of the big, sort of the way your book is arranged, you say that there are three vectors that will determine the outcome of what we're talking about here, the most important battle in human history. As you say, it's no longer an argument, it's a battle. I will open it now for you to, I'll say them first and then let you flesh them out. The first is the economic argument, the plummeting cost of renewable energy. The second is the power or ways of diminishing the power of the fossil fuel industry. And third is the rise of climate movement. So take it away and sort of flesh those out for folks.
Absolutely. I mean, these are the key vectors. There's forces here. One is this plummeting cost of renewable energy. The engineers have done their job. As badly as the politicians did theirs, that's how well the engineers have done their part of this. And so now we have cheap renewable energy, widely available, not just in the developed world. In some ways, it's even more powerful in the developing world. And the book includes a lot of reporting from parts of remote rural parts of, say, Africa, where people are seeing power for the first time and it's coming from a solar panel. When you're in those places, you're reminded of the almost miraculous nature of this technology. I mean, the fact that you can point a sheet of glass at the sun and out the back flows power and information and light and things. That's, Hogwarts scale magic, and we should be very grateful for it. The second force is the force of the fossil fuel industry. There remain, though wounded, extraordinarily powerful, and you can see that power in the Trump administration. They've gotten everything they wanted. Trump, just the other day, last week, put forward new executive orders, making it harder to oppose pipelines, trying to screw up the divestment movement. So whenever they're threatened, they have the political capital to respond. And the same around the world. Vladimir Putin is a oil the boss of a petrostate, Mohammed bin Salman, the murderer in Saudi Arabia. You know, the only reason people pay him fealty is because of the oil beneath his sand. So they're extraordinarily powerful, and they use that power in every way to dominate our political system. So the third force, and the variable one that I was describing before, is the movement that's designed to depress the power of the fossil fuel industry and grease the skids for the rise of renewable power. That's people out in the streets. That's people willing sometimes to go to jail. That's people making electoral change and pushing hard for candidates to do and say the right things. That's what movements look like. And the power of that movement will determine the speed of this transition, which in turn will determine just how bad things are going to get.
Okay, I'm going to add some of the stuff I gleaned from reading through your work lately, just to add a few numbers and facts and so on. One is that in addition to the costs of runaway climate change, economic costs is the human costs, and the median estimate from the International Organization for Migration is that we may see 200 million climate refugees by 2050. And as you point out, that makes what has happened with the, you know, war in Syria's refugees, which has already upset Europe, Britain, the United States, and, you know, fueled all of these populists and so on, that this is on a scale which we've never seen before, if it should happen. And by the way, as you also point out, some of what the war in Syria, the migration from the Mideast to Europe is caused by climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the scientists are clear that the deepest drought in the history of what we once called the Fertile Crescent drove much of the early disintegration of Syria. An even closer example is what's going on in Central America. There's a terrific story on the front page of the New York Times this Sunday all about the fact that immigration from that part of the world to the southern border is largely climate refugees fleeing a drought that's made farming impossible across Honduras and Guatemala. If you look at a map, Central America is almost unique on the planet for having big oceans on both sides nearby. And the rapid rise in the temperature of those oceans seems to have led to the dramatic drought that's been afflicting that part of the world. Californians can sympathize because they've been through horrific drought themselves. But, of course, California is rich enough that it doesn't produce, you know, refugees at the moment, except the people who get burned out of their homes. But this is, you know, in certain ways very reminiscent of where, you know, what happened in California in the 1930s.
The Dust Bowl.
The distance between San Pedro Sula and Honduras and California is pretty much exactly the same as the distance between Tulsa, Oklahoma and California. So the migration shouldn't take us entirely by surprise. Just be prepared for it to be, as you pointed out, 100 times what we're seeing now as the number of refugees ramps up inexorably over the course of the century.
Yeah, one of the things that in reading your book and some of your recent articles and really throwing myself into this over the last couple of days is to see how sort of the feedback loops, and I don't mean the ones that you may think, but the very people who oppose migration, oppose doing anything about climate change, the very companies that oppose decentralization of energy, one of the reasons they oppose it is because their power to oppose it depends on it not happening because of the money they reap. It's just when you begin to pull the leaves or the onion, you can see that it's complex, but it makes a lot of sense if you follow what I'm saying. Let me also give a few things about the economic argument, the plummeting cost of renewable energy versus coal. And I'll say a couple of things I've learned, and then you can flesh that out. In 2017, sun and wind produced, this is 2017, just 6% of the world's electric supply, but made up 45% of the growth in supply. The cost of sun and wind power continues to fall by 20% with each doubling of capacity. So what you're saying is that although you can sort of say, oh, but it's just a small thing, if you're an investor or if you're the head of a company, you can't just look at what's happening today. You have to look at the trends. And the trends are that the investment is going to renewables and the disinvestment is happening to fossil fuels. Peabody,
exactly,
the world's
right.
largest private sector coal mining company, goes from Fortune's list of most admired companies in 2008 to bankrupt in 2016.
And blames divestment as one of the reasons. And correctly so, because people have really begun to put a crimp in that industry. The thing to realize economically is that the thing that investors care about is growth. And at this point, pretty much all the growth is coming in renewable energy. I mean, even look at, say, the car market. Most of the growth now around the world is being captured in places like China by electric cars. There aren't anywhere near as many electric cars yet as there are internal combustion engines, but most of the growth is being captured by them, and that's why, say, Tesla ended up with a higher market cap for a while than Ford or GM. Because investors can tell what's coming down the pike.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to remember. It's not just what it looks like today. You're right. Investment is always based on growth. It's even when a stock like Apple, which for years was a growth stock, becomes the largest company in the world, and then suddenly people say, well, you know, maybe the iPhone market is saturated. Mm-hmm. Suddenly it's not nearly as attractive. Still enormously valuable, great market cap. But
right, and but now imagine if you're Apple and someone else has figured out a better technology than the
yeah.
smartphone. I don't know what it is,
yeah.
but
telepathy.
You know, something you implant in your
yeah.
fingernail or something. Then you're really in trouble. And that's what's happening here. I mean, they're going to have their lunch eaten for them by renewable energy. The question is whether the process can happen fast enough or not.
That's right.
I'm not in any despair about whether we're going to make this transition.
Yeah.
50 years from now, the world's going to run on sun and wind because it's free, and that's an unbeatable advantage. The question is, I mean, and current trajectories, the world that we run on sun and wind in 50 years will be a fundamentally broken world. If we make the transition faster, it will be less broken.
Right. I see that image, yes. It will be a renewable energy world. But what world will that be?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Let me just point out one other thing if people want just one of those tidbits you throw out. In 2017, Kentucky's Coal Mining Museum installed solar panels on its roof to save $10,000 a year on electric costs.
Yep.
I just love throw that one around at Easter dinner.
The handwriting's on the roof, as they say.
Yes, yes. Okay, so that now talk a bit, since we're talking the economic, talk a bit more about the divestment movement. That when you started it, as I say, I can remember being at one of your earliest things where you're putting forward this idea. It has grown enormously, and there are big players now.
Right. Started it out thinking, well, we'll get colleges and universities, because that's what happened with the anti-apartheid divestment movement in the 1980s. It was really Naomi Klein and I that kind of dreamt up this divestment idea, and we'd both been active in that when we were in college. And so that's where we began. And it's been quite successful there. I mean, around the world, half the colleges in the UK are divested now and things like that. But it quickly spread beyond that, partly because people are concerned about climate change and partly because people began to figure out what we were saying meant that they were going to lose money on fossil fuels, which indeed it's been the worst performing sector of the market these last years. And so more and more people have joined in, and now they're big players. I mean, the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is $1 trillion, New York City's pension fund, which is $200 billion, the largest insurance companies in France and Italy, the entire country of Ireland, all its public funds now divested from fossil fuel So it's been a remarkable ride, and it's clearly making a difference. I mean, earlier this year, Shell Oil listed divestment as a material risk to its business. A couple of weeks ago at the big annual fossil fuel conference in Houston, Politico reporters found a room full of coal executives, all of whom were going on the record at great length about how divestment had made it largely impossible for them to raise new capital. There were just too many funds that no longer would play with them. And that was a very good thing to read.
Yeah. And one of the things that we've talked about it already, the relationship of the enormous money that the fossil fuel industry gave them, enormous power politically and so on. And as you say, to the degree that the fossil fuel industry is weakened by some combination of technological change and furious activism, the chances for serious change increase. This is one of those feedback loops I'm talking about. As they lose that enormous hold on money, they lose some of their ability to influence things. And you talk about the fact that we are in the U.S., which most people may not know, but up until 1973 was the world's largest producer of fossil fuels. And the change in America's wages dates from exactly that moment. Real wages rose from World War II until 1973. 1973, the year where we were no longer the world's largest producer of fossil fuels, that began to change, and real wages have not kept pace ever since. But one of the things you point out is that renewables, because of their decentralization, can empower developing countries in a way that they're dependent so far on fossil fuels controlled by Russia, the U.S., a few countries and a few companies. The liberating ripple effects are enormous.
And that's right. For about 80% of the people in the world, they live in countries that are importers of fossil fuel, and that import bill is often the single biggest drag on their economy. I mean, this is true in African nations and in South America and much of Asia. And so for them, there's a kind of double liberation that comes with the switch to renewable energy. You're liberated from the choking pollution that comes with burning fossil fuel, and you're liberated from having to figure out every month how you're going to come up with enough dollars to buy the fuel that your economy requires. And that's really why China and India are really in the forefront of this move to renewable energy, and they're putting up renewable energy faster than any place on Earth. And that's a very encouraging thing to watch, and it should worry Americans, because we're clearly, under Trump, trying to stick ourselves with 18th century technology.
Yeah. No, what is interesting, yes, is that when the power countries were also fossil fuel producing countries, U.S., Russia, you know, Cold War and so on, the world looked one way. But right now, the countries that are have the fastest growing economies, they can opt out of servitude toward the fossil fuel industry for the future. And that changes the whole map.
Absolutely. Look, Exxon, the people who run these companies, are not stupid. They know what the future holds. They're just trying to play for their keeping their current business model for another 20 or 30 years. And the problem with that is that if they're successful, those will be the 20 or 30 years that really do break the planet. So we just have to figure out how to make the change faster than economics alone would produce. That's the political game here. That's why it's so important that we, among other things, don't waste any more election cycles.
That's right. That's right. And let me read a quote that I read just after the election that has become sort of something that kind of holds as a North Star for me. And it's from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, the guy who wrote The Little Prince.
Oh, yes.
If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. And it seems to me that's what we've got to do, that on the one hand is the threat, but on the other is to instill in people you know, a narrative, a story, a vision that allows them to feel they are joining something which is going to be glorious.
One way of saying this is that on these really huge issues, what activists fight for is not particular pieces of legislation. It's to shift the zeitgeist, to shift the sense of what's normal and natural and obvious, of what we want to happen. Some of that comes from fear, and fear is a correct response to the situation we find ourselves in. As Greta Thunberg said at Davos earlier this year to the world business leaders, I want you to panic. there's good reason for that, and there's also good reason to try and imagine the world on the other side. Look, we're not talking about utopias that we're trying to build, but we are talking about local communities and economies that are able to fend for themselves far better than they are now, that aren't sending all their money off to Saudi Arabia all the time, or North Dakota, or Houston, or wherever else, not helping the Koch brothers with their project of dominating our political life. And that's a future worth fighting for.
Yeah. The organizations, the websites that people should do if they're willing to get out of their comfort zone.
Well, I'd go to 350.org and also find your local 350 chapter, because they're scattered all around the world. I'd definitely go check out the people at the Sunrise Movement and help with this move toward a Green New Deal. And I'd keep my eyes open on all kinds of different websites for what I hope will be a broad-based push for serious climate strike of some kind, probably as early as this autumn. So get ready to organize. That's all I can tell you.
So this autumn, a climate strike, and next autumn, we change our government.
Let's hope.
Okay, so again, Bill McKibben's latest book is Falter. The websites are BillMcKibben.com and 350.org. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to TerrenceMcNally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. Terrence McNally is TerrenceMcNally. And A World That Just Might Work is all those words as one. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, plus 8 or 9 articles of relevance that sort of flesh out that conversation, email me at temcnally@mac.com or go to my website. You can sign up there. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. You can listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Mark Maxwell and Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And thank you, Bill McKibben. Keep up the good work.
Well, you too. What a pleasure to have such an informed and interesting discussion. It was a real pleasure, man.
Thank you, Bill.